Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time with your host here, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona. Now I want to thank you for tuning into the Hour of the Time, and you can thank yourself for what you are going to learn. We're going to do a classic flashback tonight on some very old material. It's from some very old recordings that had been on reel to reel, and then a firm that I had contact with that was the remnants of the original people converted those reel-to-reels in the 60s to LP vinyl to better distribute it and use it in schools, public meetings, etc. I had the fortune of meeting some very old researchers in the late 80s, the people who really were the root nationwide of the wake-up call to the people of America concerning our loss of our constitutional republic. People that had done more by 1950. That's right. That's how far back many of these people had been researching and exposing the International Socialist Movement. But had done more by 1950 than most people will do in their entire life, let alone all the subsequent years of research. So I suggest you take notes, ladies and gentlemen. Rare recordings like this are intentionally taken off library shelves, taken out of thrift shops, collector stores, and destroyed, and they always have been, by socialist sales throughout the country. Right out of the Library of Congress, stolen and destroyed. I was fortunate enough to befriend a very elderly couple who gave me an entire collection where they had, throughout the 30s and 40s and 50s, had as a group throughout the country recorded tons of prominent speakers and authors, ambassadors, generals, on the threat of world communism, world government, International Monetary Fund, the UN. And like I said, had it done on reel-to-reel tape originally, and then converted it for easier distribution in the 60s to LPs, and I was given an entire set of these LPs. Now, to even find these by the proper title, date, everything, the small little studio in Southern California that pressed all the LPs. I typed in 14 just random out of the stack that I have. And of those, I found one firm that had a cover only for one of the records out of my entire Google search. So you can get the gist of the rarity of these recordings. Yet the information is so pertinent because many of these authors back then and speakers were real researchers, like we constantly strive here at the Hour of the Time. They didn't just say communists did this or so-and-so department did this. They give you names, dates, agendas, meetings, places, times. So I would suggest, while I'm doing the prefatory notes for the show this evening here, that you get yourself a notebook and be ready to write this down. Now, of course, we'll have it for a limited time on our website, hourofthetime.com. That's hourofthetime.com, to listen to again. But remember, we are listener-supported, ladies and gentlemen, and all our broadcasts since 1993 are available on CD. Now, if you order a lot of copies and you want them, or a lot of different broadcasts, and you want them in MP3 format, just indicate so in your envelope or PayPal notes or whatever method you use to order. Now, because we're listener-supported, and it's a double-edged sword here, we have the ability to not be stifled with stupid commercials like most of the networks every 3 to 4 minutes, selling miracle cures that don't work, high, overpriced gold and silver coins, taking advantage of the fear again, just like for Y2K, so-called patriots basically pillaging the American people. We have the right to say without being stifled what needs to be said, without meeting some quota for sales, like most of the disc jockeys out there that call themselves patriot talk show hosts, or constitutionalists they call themselves. Yet they can hardly tell you anything about the Constitution if you query them. Oh, they got it memorized in very few cases. But the background and meaning and intent, they're lacking. But not here at Hour of the Time. That's not the case. And the other thing, the downside is with fluctuations in the audience being listener supported, is hence fluctuations in support itself. Our electricity doesn't go down. Airtime doesn't go down. Telephones, faxes, internet, serving fees for the website that's free 365 days a year. There's no special sections where we charge you a subscription fee or anything like that. So please consider that, ladies and gentlemen, when you gain this useful information. Don't just assume because, oh, well, they've got it for 2 or 3 days on their website, plus our live broadcast every evening, that you can listen, turn it off, and be done with it. Because the bills aren't just done with, and we can't expand our research and constantly increase our output without your support. Nothing in this world is free, ladies and gentlemen, although many socialist Americans, which is about 90% of the population, seem to think so. They seem to think that because they can click on it and download it, that it's free. Didn't cost anybody anything to produce, research, no overhead involved whatsoever, is the mindset. And while they're at it, pirate it and distribute it all over and sell them on eBay. Again, regardless of the fact that we're solely listener supported. Directly. Not you selling pirated items on eBay. Now, ladies and gentlemen, to highlight a few of the things we've been doing here behind the scenes, I've had several speaking engagements in the last 2 or 3 months, speaking to state assemblies, county coalitions, county supervisors, boards of supervisors, congressmen, senators, on the very real threat, the number one threat, ladies and gentlemen, in all my research, to our constitutional republic, and that is the land rights issue. Trust me, I've studied the firearms issue immensely. But it isn't the crux. There's a lot of ways around firearms bans, even though they're completely unconstitutional, right in your own backyard. There's ways around it. But you can do nothing without property. You cannot produce goods. You cannot barter goods. You cannot have a place that you can call your homestead, your home, your place, what have you. You cannot truly have security. You can't prosper without working the land, the minerals, the resources, and producing beneficial goods for the end consumer. That is the production of real goods, real economy, and prosperity. And what this very country is based on. The property rights issue, ladies and gentlemen, is the crux. And I've been speaking all over concerning this issue, educating from Joe Smith down the street that just wants to come by, to church leaders, to legislators, on these very topics, the real threats that are out there, the plan of global biodiversity, as it's called, to entrap you into metropolitan areas and have utter control of your entire life, the food supply, the supply of all raw materials and natural resources and minerals, supply and demand of travel is what they'll turn it into. Permit-based systems, because they'll have you landlocked when they get their confiscation of private property rights. You'll think that you own your vehicle, but it'll be collectively owned, ladies and gentlemen. You think you'll own your house, it will be collectively owned. And so, because of that, at one of the engagements, we filmed it, called the Property Rights Seminar. It's a 4-DVD set, available again at our website, hourofthetime.com. And I'm in the midst currently of a long multi-part audio broadcast that we've been airing. We're up to 6 parts so far, and we'll finish the rest this week live on the history, force, and use of land patents and allodial titles. Allodium, ladies and gentlemen. True ownership of your properties. And I'm not just talking land, ladies and gentlemen. So you better wake up. I'm going to, in the next couple weeks, give the audience as well many recommendations of things that you need to be looking at, and my solid research-based justifications for things that you need to be putting aside for upcoming events. And upcoming catastrophes, as they could be called, that you better be prepared to face and handle. Or plan on getting in the government line and ushered to the government camp or gymnasium to systematically, not only by your fellow countrymen, but your government especially, to be pillaged, raped, and robbed of all that you have left. And then, when you are of no use, you will be disposed of. Now, ladies and gentlemen, one might say, well, why don't you just hurry up and blurt all that out? Because, ladies and gentlemen, there is a vast void out there of knowledge. Every time I get a phone call from the audience or an email, it's proven to me more and more. And unless you understand the history behind the agenda, you can't understand the agenda whatsoever. So we give you these historical recordings, articles, research papers, sections of books. So through understanding of the very foundation of what started our slide down that slippery slope to tyranny, then you can fully understand how to avoid it and fight it. Now, if you'd like to contact the Hour of the Time again, the website, hourofthetime.com, the studio number, 928-333-2942, my personal email, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, to give you a little background on what you're about to listen to today, he described himself as a retread from World War I. George Racy Jordan abandoned civilian success as sales and advertising executive to re-enter the military in World War II. As Lend-Lease expediter at Great Falls, Montana, in charge of air freight to Moscow, Major Jordan grew progressively suspicious of the sealed and so-called diplomatic cargoes. Over violent protest, he examined them closely. What he discovered, ladies and gentlemen, became the basis for his almost incredible revelations to Fulton Lewis Jr. and subsequently to the House Committee on Un-American Activities. Notwithstanding the security blockade and despite the specific limitations declared by the Congress in approving Lend-Lease legislation, everything from our atomic plans and materials to top-secret State Department memoranda flowed in a steady, subversive stream down the Red Pipeline to Moscow. Congress was horrified to learn that our government's gifts to communism even included master plates from the U.S. Treasury so that Russia could print its own occupation currency, which we had to redeem. Government agencies handed the Red Butchers the greatest mail order catalog in history, with all items paid for by unsuspecting Americans. Inevitably, Major Jordan became the target of the heavily financed character assassins, smear artists, and communist fronts. That his fully documented testimony was unimpeachable is perhaps most succinctly described by John O'Donnell in the New York Daily News, who said, "His statements prove true." And it was Senator Pat McCarran who commented, "The Jordan charges explain why Russia was able to get our atomic secrets and produce a bomb far ahead of schedule." Or, as the Omaha World Herald put it in a lead editorial, quote, "Developments thus far indicate that Major Jordan knows what he's talking about, and they suggest that the events he witnessed in Great Falls may have been part of a much larger conspiracy to give the Soviets everything they sought, including atomic materials which were supposed to be super secret, and engineered plans for the American atomic plants." This expose, ladies and gentlemen, of the unconscionable deceit employed by those high administration offices will infuriate you. But it will show you where our money, our honor, and a large measure of our freedom have gone. George Racy Jordan, retired, wasted no time on broad generalities in this revealing record. He tells you who did what. He links the world communist threat to the international communist conspiracy, International Monetary Fund, and world government. He tells you precisely where to obtain the documentation and the government's own records. Then he makes the shocking revelation that under the quote-unquote new frontier, many of those branded as agents of the Soviet subversion squad are not only back in government, but actually in positions of greater influence than they were when they were expelled. The facts are all here, ladies and gentlemen, but information without action is sterile. The value of the facts lies in what you do about the situation.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I preface my remarks by saying that I don't want to have you under any misapprehensions. I am an extreme middle-of-the-roader. The only organizations that I have ever joined, the American Legion, and in the 40 years that I've been a member of the American Legion, the last 20 I have been guests of state conventions and individual Legion posts. I haven't been too active in the last 20 of the 40 years. I'm also a member of the Retired Officers Association, and for the last 20 years I've never attended a meeting. I'm a registered Republican, and I only drink Birch beer. back in the Army as a retread in 1942, never occurred to me that the assignment that I had would prove to be important, but I was puzzled because I was immediately, because of my First World War experience, I was made executive officer of the Newark Airport. And there was where the supplies for the Russians was taking off by boat. And it was there that I first came in contact with the Russians. And almost immediately, the Russians asked me if I would please help them because they had something very important that they wanted to accomplish. And I said, why, certainly, I'm an expediter and I'll do whatever you want me to do. What is it you want? They said they'd like to go on relief right away, please. I tried to explain to them that it was not possible for the Lend-Lease administration to put these Russians on the relief program, that that was an entirely different administration. But I did suggest, however, sort of passing the buck, as we learned when we were sergeants, and of course you know the sergeants really won the First World War. I passed the buck back to their embassy. And much to my amazement, they came to me a few weeks later and said that my suggestion had been very good because they had now had the city of Leningrad put on relief. Well, of course, I didn't believe it, and I asked to see the papers. And much to my amazement, because I had read the law, the Lend-Lease law that your Congress had spelled out exactly was that Russians were to receive warfare materials only. And it said in the law, there's none of this money to be used for relief or rehabilitation. So when the money started to mount up to where they got to be nearly $100 million, I decided that I should keep a few notes. Because I remembered that in the First World War, there were two or three officers went to jail for ordering saddles for the tanks. And I was a little bit afraid after that experience that something might be hung on our office in Newark, so I decided to keep notes. The notes turned into voluminous files because we had a quaint custom in the Air Corps of making 13 copies in person. And I naturally picked up one of those copies. Now, after I began to observe that the Russians were more interested in rebuilding Russia through the Lend-Lease program and did not seem to be anxious to get warfare supplies, but were more anxious to get certain specific items that I could visualize were for the use of rebuilding the war damage of Russia, I became doubly suspicious. Many of you may recall that we were very short of tankers. And because we were so short of tankers, we had Navy balloons out over the Atlantic Ocean guarding the few tankers that we did have, so that the German wolf packs wouldn't pick off the tankers one by one. But we had a program under the Lend-Lease, which the taxpayers never heard of, for taking these tankers through the Panama Canal up into Seattle so that we could deliver to Vladivostok $100 million worth of vodka. That was the vodka program. Now, of course, I do remember that we got some of it back in diplomatic containers at Yalta. But as we went along with this program, and the Russians wanted me to help them to get a bomb powder plant, I agreed to help them, and turned out that the materials that they wanted for a bomb powder plant were actually for the building of an atom bomb. And as we started sending the various materials through for the atom bomb plant, it was all sorts of heavy water and uranium and electrical panel equipment and a great deal of other expensive equipment. I did not know about the Manhattan Project. So there was no way that a few officers that were assisting in the expediting could tell what the individual item was going to be for in the end product. We sent them something like $400 million worth of power equipment, hydroelectric plants and steam engine plants. Now, the more we went into this and the less military material we were sending, the more suspicious I became that there must be something wrong. And I went to Washington, and much to my amazement, they told me in Washington they knew all about it and that I mustn't get too officious or I'd find myself on a small island in the South Pacific somewhere. I didn't want to go to a small island in the South Pacific. So I started keeping very quiet, but sending reports through. Then the Russians started sending these black patent leather suitcases through, and I started to try to open them, and I found that a Mr. Charles Bolin of the State Department had given them diplomatic immunity. No one could open these suitcases because they were covered by diplomatic immunity. Now, my idea of diplomatic immunity was a courier carrying a diplomatic pouch that was locked from one embassy to another. So I decided to spot check some of these suitcases, and in opening the suitcases, of course, it was like opening Pandora's box. I found all the things in there that the Russians didn't want anyone to know they were taking, and that was the cause of my being subpoenaed later on. I found the drawings of Oak Ridge, where we were making our atom bomb, all sorts of things. And as I opened these suitcases, I found State Department documents where the secret stamp had been cut off, and the scalloped on the paper showed that there'd been some kind of a mark on there, but it had been taken off, it had been trimmed. Otherwise, I would have had to ground the plane. And I made a violent complaint about this. And I found that this material that was coming from the State Department was being sent to the Russians by a man named Dr. Theodore Geiger. So when I went to Washington, I started checking on Dr. Geiger. And I found that the New York State hearings, the Rat-Kuder hearings into the school communist program, had uncovered a communist by the name of William Canning. And Mr. Canning had testified before the Kuder committee that he was a communist, and he was helping his history professor, who was running five simultaneous communist cells in CCNY. Well, of course, Dr. Geiger was promptly fired. And then he disappeared. But they had it on the record. They knew that he was identified by a communist as being one of the secret underground leaders of the Communist Party. So when I told some of the senators in Washington and discussed this with them, they said, well, where is this fellow now? I said, I don't know. But I said, keep your eye open, because I said, they're like termites. They go out of one end of the building and fly around and get in the other end of the building. They do their damage before the building collapses. The next we learned, there was a lawyer named Peter Hoge in New York. And Peter Hoge arranged for the habeas corpus that caused the woman to jump out of the window, Mrs. Kosinkina, that fell on the clothesline, and her life was saved, and she broke her legs and went to the hospital. And Peter Hoge came forward and said that he had been fired in Europe by Mr. Paul Hoffman, because he went to Mr. Hoffman and said, I know the leader of the Communist Party is working for you over here. He's got three cells running. He's got one in Bonn, one in Frankfurt, and one in Paris. And Mr. Harriman and Mr. Hoffman had a conference, and they fired Hoge. Not Dr. Geiger, they fired Hoge. So Hoge and I got together, and we compared notes. And so we went to Senator McCarthy. And Senator McCarthy called up the State Department. He gave him 48 hours to get rid of Geiger. And in the short time, he retired for physical disability so he could save his pension, and he disappeared again. But there was an article in the Wall Street Journal and various papers that told about the organization of the Fund for the Republic. The Fund for the Republic was part of the Ford Foundation situation, and they wanted to put Mr. Hoffman into a separate situation where he could smear all the anti-communists. So they started this Fund for the Republic. And there were two officials running the fund, Dr. Geiger and a man named Adam Yamolinsky. Now, when we discovered that he was no longer in the government, and we couldn't get rid of him because he was not working for Uncle Sam, we decided to keep our eye on him. So they created a new organization in Washington called the National Planning Association. This is part of this new urban renewal business that the president's trying to get a cabinet member in now on this business. That's all planned by the Planning Commission. So we noticed on the 30th of November last, an article in the paper that Congress had decided to save the dollar. So they had called in an expert to help save the gold and to help save the dollar. And the man they'd called in was none other than Dr. Theodore S. Geiger. Now, when I got out of the Army and I was invited to California by the Daughters of the American Revolution, And don't ever get in the clutches of the Daughters of the American Revolution. If you've ever seen John L. Lewis run a CIO meeting, you've never seen anything, because these Daughters of the American Revolution, when they run a meeting, they run it with a it's just fantastic how they run a meeting. I heard one of them in Washington once. She said, "What's that? Carry rifles? Certainly we can carry rifles. Did I hear any names? No, there better not be any." It's been my experience to be in 30 states and in over 500 cities, and I want to tell you that these ladies of the Daughters of the American Revolution are the hard knot in the web of the fabric of the resistance in this country, and you can't do that. They don't have any inhibitions about it. If you're against this country's basic interest, they'll scratch your eyes out. Now, these worthy ladies invited me to California to speak to the Commonwealth Club. My book had been published at that time, and it was in the Reader's Digest. It had been published in 17-some-odd foreign languages, I believe it was, throughout the world. I thought that I would have something new to tell these members of the Commonwealth Club. So instead of discussing the uranium and equipment and the master maps of the treasury that we sent to Russia so they could print the occupation money, which was in the Reader's Digest in February 1953, and the various facets of my testimony, I decided to tell the men in California something new. I told the men in San Francisco that they had been told by the New Deal in Washington that all the gold mining machinery of California was necessary for the copper part of the war effort, and they all patriotically gave up their machinery. But I was going to tell them that it didn't go for the copper part of the war effort. We assembled it up in Seattle, and we shipped it to Vladivostok. So the Russians, with slave labor, got into the gold mining business, and we're still out of business here in California. This was done by Mr. Harry Dexter White and Mr. Alger Hiss and the other members of the International Monetary Fund, which came down from the Bretton Woods Agreement, Frank Coe and Harold Glasser and a number of them, all been pulled out by your Congress and held up by the scruff of the neck and thrown out as communists. But the edifice that they created still has a situation that's hard to describe. I told the men in San Francisco, the Commonwealth Club, that there was no chance for them to get back in the mining of gold because the price of gold had been fixed at $35 an ounce back in 1934, and that unless we could get the price up to around $90 an ounce, you'd never be able to open these gold mines. Can you think what would happen in the 12 western states if you could open 9,000 closed gold mines? Why, you'd have prosperity out here that would affect everyone. But we can't open these gold mines, which are full of water, because the price of gold, which was fixed in 1934 at $35 an ounce, the dollar has gone down in purchasing power, and when you receive 35 paper tokens for an ounce of gold, you're only getting about $16 in value. And in the meantime, the wages and everything that has to do with labor and the cost of equipment and electricity has gone up 2,000%. So there isn't any chance of doing this unless you can get the acquiescence of the other fund members, in which Harry Dexter White and Alger Hiss have enmeshed us into a situation where we do not control our own destiny anymore. You can't raise the price of gold without the permission of these people who won't give it. It was planned that way. It's planned that you'll have the paper tokens in your pocket that go down in purchasing power, while the people who have the gold gets firmer and firmer and firmer as your money gets thicker and thicker and thicker. The dollars you have in your pocket are going down at the rate of 3 to 3.5% in purchasing power every year, because Mr. McChesney Martin of the Federal Reserve has testified before the Banking Committee of the Congress that he's taking it down scientifically every year. Why? Because the unions have to have more money. Wages have to go up. So as the wages go up and the people get more take-home money, they think they're getting more value and purchasing power, but they're getting less because the money they take home, well, figure it out. If you have a bond that's bringing you in 4.25% per year and your money's going down to 3.5% per year and you're paying income tax on the 4.25% you get from the bond, you're going behind all the time, and that's planned that way. Don't think that these Fabian socialist planners who call themselves politicians are anything but red pinkos, only they're so yellow they don't dare call themselves red. Now, seriously, folks, without any facetious intent, I'd like to ask you if you've ever heard an extreme right-winger take the Fifth Amendment. I never have. The people who were giving all these things to the Russians were what I call Fabian socialist planners. Now, they can call themselves Democrats if they want to and attach themselves like barnacles to the Democratic Party, but I do not consider them real good Democrats, the Jim Farley type of Democrats that I used to know. And the men in New York State, like Al Smith, who used to stand there and say, "Let's take a look at the record." And I say this evening, it would be kind of interesting to take a look at the record. Now, I told you about Dr. Geiger, who's now in Washington advising the Congress on how to save the country's dollar. Many of you perhaps have never heard of a report that the Un-American Activities Committee got out called Index 9. Now, Index 9 is getting very scarce. They've been emasculated in the libraries, they've disappeared. Anyone who had one, they've loaned them and they've gone. And in fact, in the 18 years since it's been published, they're very scarce. I was offered $500 by a publisher for this copy of Index 9. Now, this is not a report from some other agency than the government. This is the House report, and it says right on the face of it, investigation of the activities of the Communist Party, and it tells the names of the associates and the sponsors and the members of the various un-American activities groups, and it's right there in black and white. And I'm wondering sometime why some of the officials in Washington, instead of coming out publicly and talking about the extremists and the reactionary disturbers and all these other people, why they don't go into their own office and take a look at the record. Now, in Index 9, I find some very interesting names. I take one name as an example. This report is extremely useful. It's in the UCLA library in the microfilm form, and anyone can go there and examine it. I'm going to take the name out of this government report of Mr. Adam Yarmolinsky. Now, Mr. Yarmolinsky, who has a conspiratorial record of the most extreme left-wing connections since 1943, when he was a Harvard editor of The Yardling, which was known as a pro-communist publication for distribution among the students. Later, he became an official of the Fund for the Republic, a $15 million foundation that you all know finances a smearing of anti-communists. Now, Yarmolinsky wrote a book attacking the House Un-American Activities Committee. And he has associated with him, behind him in his listings in this, the entire Marxist organizations. Now, he's a member of the John Reed clubs. Mr. John Reed is buried in the foot of the Kremlin Wall along with Big Bill Haywood. And where is this Mr. Adam Yarmolinsky today? That's the important thing. It isn't so important to go back years and look at what happened unless you can learn, unless you can get from this education of the past so that we can protect ourselves and see that it doesn't happen again in the future. That's the reason that these reports are so valuable, because many of these people have their roots buried deep in the Marxist indoctrinating and the tearing out of the foundations of this republic. Now, Mr. Adam Yarmolinsky, today, under the New Frontier, is in charge of recruiting the executive personnel as a special assistant to the Secretary of Defense in room 3E941, the Pentagon. Mr. McNamara refused to give the name of the people that surround him. I'm not muzzled. I'll be glad to give you their name. How do you think the security-minded generals that have to work in the Pentagon, how do they feel knowing that in the next room, in charge of special assignments, why, he can call anything he wishes a special assignment. They have to go round him or through him to get to McNamara. A man with a record like this, you don't read about this in the newspapers. You read about how horrible the extreme right-wingers are doing things. Now, at a presidential press conference, Mrs. McClendon raised the question whether two well-known security risks employed by the State Department were considered by the President to be properly cleared for employment. When the President demanded the names, she mentioned two. One of them was Mr. William A. Whelan. The President replied with noticeable anger that Mr. Whelan had been specifically considered and was highly competent and able to perform the tasks to which he was assigned, period. I'd like to recommend that you read a book called Red Star Over Cuba, and you'll find all about Mr. William Whelan and also Mr. Roy Rubottom, another worthy. When this book came out, he was quietly transferred out as Assistant Secretary of State. And, of course, in the Army, we have a situation where when a man fails, we fire him. In the State Department, when they fail, they're promoted. Mr. Edgar Hoover told President Truman 5 times about Harry White, and 5 times Truman promoted him. Now, in this book, you'll read all about Mr. Roy Rubottom. He's now liaison between the State Department and the War College, so he can teach the fellows in the War College how they should expect to be muzzled. Those are just a couple of little examples that I want to give you. When I was in Washington, I said to one of the senators, I understand that the remark has been made up in here to the daughters of the American Revolution, just name us a communist, name us one. We'd like to have people send us in the information. And my answer to it is, get a copy of Index 9 out of your own back library there and read it. They're all there. Here's one that I think's rather interesting. This is his application for a job in the War Department, and this is his own handwriting. Now, he won the prize for getting the most number of communists in the United States in the party. So what was his prize? Why, he went to New York to meet Mr. Browder, and Mr. Browder says, you're a fine, upstanding young communist. I'm going to promote you. Got your back? Where do I go? He tells in here where he went. He went to the office of the chief of staff and he's in charge of examining the desks of the generals to make sure they were locked according to security regulations. Now, imagine a man winning a prize for getting the most communists and his new job is in the Joint Chiefs of Staff office examining the general's desks and tidying up the incoming and outgoing boxes to make sure they're all in order. When we got him on the witness stand, they asked him, they said, well, what did you do otherwise? He always said he supplied ink and rubber bands and new blotters for the general. Now, as the war got rolling along, they decided they better promote him. So now, if I was asked to promote a man that was in the office of the chief of staff to a better job, I'd have a hard time figuring where to put him. But they didn't. According to his own record now, he's in the office of the Secretary of War, who was very busy grading and evaluating the civilian employees and deciding on their salaries and hiring them in the Secretary of War's office. And he says here, liaison between the various branches of the Army. The Secretary of War was too busy, so he turned it all over to him. He was very expert. They're always very competent for the task to which they're assigned. When the war was over, they put him in the office of the Quartermaster General, where he became field analyst in charge of personnel for the depots throughout the world, Guam, China, India, Africa. And when I showed this to Senator Ferguson, I said to him, I said, may I show you who his references were? And Senator Ferguson, it was early in the morning, he had a glass of milk in his hand. He kept shaking his hand so the milk was spilling. He said, I can't take it. He said, I got to get the committee meeting. He said, I just can't stand it. He said, why, that man could have hired hundreds of people. And I said, I want to show you his references. He said, I just can't stand it anymore. So make your own attitude to get subpoenaing him. Get this is horrible. But finally, he did look up and he said, well, just name the top reference. So I named the top reference for him. They all stick together like a bunch of ducks, you know. They promote each other and recommend each other. And his first reference is the manager of Oak Ridge, Tennessee, making the C-bomb, Mr. Brennan. This is one of the samples that I have. I had hundreds of samples given to me by members of the different staffs. And I would like to tell you that this record of a man going to the Chief of Staff's office, and then to the Secretary of War's office, and then to the Quartermaster General's office, and then they arrested him. He was personnel manager of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. How do they do it? It's because they have people in the right place at the right time to put them into the position where they can do the most damage. And those are the things that I have been fighting, because I happen to have had the privilege of having read so many military reports that gave me the opportunity that I decided to make it my business as a hobby to research on some of these things. And in Index 9, I find some other things that are very interesting. Now, I spoke to you about this urban renewal, which Dr. Geiger was working on. Now, the President has just asked for a new office as a cabinet minister's job. And he inadvertently said that, and if they'll give me this new cabinet position, I will name Dr. Robert Weaver as the new cabinet member. So I promptly looked up Dr. Weaver in the government's own report here, which the government issued so the public would have a chance to see who these people were that were helping the communist movement. And I find that Dr. Weaver has 4 citations as being a hardcore communist runner. Five citations. Now, these are not innocent fronts. These show that his activity for years and years and years has been in the Marxist movement. But he will not be the first cabinet member that President Kennedy has that is mentioned in Index 9, because Mr. Arthur Goldberg has 4 citations. And they're not the first person in high office that have citations in this Index 9. Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt has 20. She even has more than some of the communist leaders. Now, they had an investigation in Washington, and they had the Secretary of War on the stand. And Senator Keating of New York asked the Secretary of War if it was true that all the tie lines going out of the Pentagon, for this is a question that they asked the Secretary of War, is there any way that the Defense Department could preclude access under existing law to the tie lines and lease lines out of the Pentagon to persons in this American Communications Association, a communist-dominated organization? And the Secretary of War said, I know of none. The next question. In other words, at the present time, although the tie lines and lease lines of the Pentagon are serviced by a communist-controlled organization, the Department of Defense, under existing law, is helpless to protect the public. Secretary War's answer, to that extent, it certainly is. Now, this is a very important question. Are you cognizant of the fact that there has been testimony before the Internal Security Subcommittee to the effect that persons under the discipline of the communists controlling the American Communications Association now have access to messages coming from the Pentagon by a monitor system whereby they can plug in and listen to these conversations? And the Secretary of War says, regrettably, yes, I know that. Another question. Are you conversant with the fact, which has been revealed by the Internal Security Subcommittee of the Senate, to the effect that restricted telegrams coming in from the Pentagon have been intercepted by persons under discipline of the communist-controlled American Communications Association? The Secretary of War says, I am aware of that. Next question. Are you conversant with the fact that the North Atlantic cable, which carries messages vital to the security of our nation, is now serviced by the American Communications Association, a communist-controlled labor organization? And the Secretary of War says, I know that too. Now, if some of the newspapers would spend a little more time looking at some of the records that are available of this testimony at various times, they would have less space to devote to the smearing of the extreme rightists. I was a guest at the Everglades Club in Florida, and I was told, you'll have to feed it to these people with a spoon. They won't take it. They don't believe it. Be awful careful, Major. Just give it them a little bitty bit at a time, because they can't stand it. So I asked them, I said, if any of you are rich enough to make a contribution to a political party and you are rewarded with an ambassadorship to some foreign country, please don't do as an ambassador did recently, Mr. Joseph E. Davies. Mr. Davies became the ambassador to Moscow, and the first secret cable that he got from the State Department, encoded message, he took it over to Litvinov, and he says, Max, I have a little room around here. Would you please help me to answer this? And Litvinov says, certainly. And he called over a member of the NKVD who spoke English, and he sat down on the typewriter, and Mr. Litvinov dictated the answer. And they handed it to Mr. Davies. Mr. Davies thanked him very much, and he went out, and he sent it to the State Department as his work. But when he went out of the door, Litvinov and the typist did a maypole dance around the typewriter. We broke the code, we broke the code, we broke the diplomatic code. And then they could read every single message that went out of the State Department to any country in the world from then on because they broke the diplomatic code. And one of the ladies in the audience said to me, why, Joe Davies is my cousin, and I'm going to sue you. Her husband told her that she'd made a mistake. She'd taken a hold of an electric eel and she'd get a shock. Because I held up a book called The Institute of Pacific Relations, which you can get in the gallery and you can go and read it yourselves, page after page of testimony about Colonel Igor Bogolepov, who's now in our Central Intelligence. And Colonel Bogolepov says that every few days, Mr. Davies would come over with another telegram, and of course, the State Department automatically changes their code so that if they are broken, by any chance, they'll have a new code all the time. But Mr. Davies was thoughtful enough to take each new cable over, and the Russians had a Roman holiday, reading all our State Department cables. But when Bogolepov finally defected to us, and he became a member of the Central Intelligence, he was called before the McCarran Committee, and you can read it here in all of the hearings, how Colonel Bogolepov says, and we were so pleased with Mr. Davies that when he left to go back to America, we handed him the manuscript of the Mission to Moscow book, which he published, which Mr. Jack Warner over here made a movie, and he received all the kudos for his wonderful work. If some of those people who live in ivory towers and don't believe in any of these things that they hear would go to the basic security of the Pentagon and learn a few things about how to protect the interests of this country, we wouldn't be in the position that we're in now. And I want to tell you that you haven't heard anything until you examine the gold in Fort Knox. We have $16 billion aid in Fort Knox. We have $22 billion obligations against it. Why? Because we have been given away all this foreign aid program. And now the money comes back as a demand for our gold in Fort Knox, and we have a golden hemorrhage out of Fort Knox. We have 73 Army bases around the world. But in case you don't know it, we have a treaty. With every one of those 73 bases, we can't fire a shot, even if we're attacked. And then secondly, through the double talk of the United Nations, we've got to go to the Political Action Committee and submit our program. And of course, the chairman of that committee's always been a Russian. Now, if these bases can't fight, and we can't evacuate them or feed them in time of war, what are they there for? Why they're spending money? It's part of socialism, to divide up what we have with these have-not countries. And all the money that they're spending comes back as a demand against the gold we have in Fort Knox, so it reduces the purchasing power of the money that you have in your pocket. And we have $22 billion obligations, and we only have $16 billion in Fort Knox. We're broke. And I think the bankers in Europe know it. But we have this economic situation where we can say to a man, please don't take your gold, because if you won't take your gold, we'll build a dike for you, or we'll do something for you. For instance, Tito. They say to Tito, wouldn't you like to have an observatory on the top of the mountain so you can watch the Sputniks go by? So now we're building an observatory for Tito on the top of the mountain so he can get in on the Sputnik program. And that's going to be done by a new program called the SUNFED program, S-U-N-F-E-D, Scientific United Nations Foreign Economic Development Program, a $70 billion program, and we're supposed to pay 70% of the $70 billion. Now, we have these task forces coming in to report to the president what's needed around the world, the various slum areas that we have to reach out and take in and do good in these areas. They're going to even go to the moon now. And I want to tell you that you haven't heard anything. Mr. Dillon went down to Uruguay and promised him, unilaterally promised him $20 billion. Senator Dodd got up on the floor of the Senate and said, since when can the executive department promise $20 billion? But you haven't heard anything until Mr. Soapy Williams, the den mother of those African groups. Now, he's already sent 13 of them up here, and they're running around down there in the United Nations in their muumuus with scarlet sashes, and they all want money. They want to have a monetary system, and they think we should help them. And as Roosevelt says, we've got to get out and do good for these people. I'd like to have her go to the Ozarks sometime and see the good that should be done down there. We've got people in this country that ought to be helped first. Whenever I've made that remark, I sometimes look the next day in the paper and I see the headline that says, Major Jordan recommends returning to isolationism. I haven't said anything about that. I am for a foreign aid program if it can be put on the back burner until we maintain the fiscal integrity of the dollar first. What we have to do to hold up this whole kettle is to see that the main pole in the middle, which is the dollar, is absolutely sound, and it must be kept sound. And the only way you can do that is to balance the budget. And they've already announced that they're going to have an $8 billion deficit this coming 30th of June, and I'll bet you it's more than that because they never prognosticated right. They're within 10 or 12 billion. And I don't know if you folks have heard of the float. The Army and the Navy, they throw all the bills up in the air on the 1st of May, look around, they don't see any bills, so they don't report them in the deficit. And when they come down on the 1st of July, then they start to pay them off. Go out here at the Rocketdyne and ask the people out there and some of the people here as to when they're being paid. They used to be paid in 30 to 60 days. Now they're being paid in 4 to 6 months. We're kiting checks, folks. That's exactly what it is. Because when they throw those bills up in the air, that's 2/12 of the annual budget of $50 billion. And that isn't put into the deficit. They all know about it down in Washington. Now, if we are in this kind of a situation, what can we do as individuals to be constructive? Not calling names to people and not doing anything that is un-American in our attempts, but something that's really constructive. We can go out and talk to people and remember that it is not controversial to stick up for your country. I've had people tell me that they didn't want to come to hear me because they were told I was so controversial that they'd be in trouble with their neighbors. And yet when they heard me, they couldn't find that I'd said anything that they would disapprove. They just thought that I was a very sound individual and that I had more common sense than emotion. Which reminds me that I'm glad my wife gave me a tranquilizer tonight so they wouldn't get too excited. These Fabian communists, planners, these Marxists that have attached themselves like barnacles to the Democratic ship, they can call themselves New Deal, Fair Deal, New Frontier, whatever they are, and they're all out of Harvard with the eyes of a zealot and a briefcase, real Phi Beta Kappa Keys. They're not Americans, in my opinion, the way they're thinking. They're one-worlders. Now, actually, ladies and gentlemen, this is a fight that we are being surrounded by Cuba, and Mexico is now going communist. We've got all these situations that are growing like water is rising, and we're on an island of free enterprise. And we must maintain the capitalistic system. The number one target that the communists have is to break the dollar and break the capitalistic system and to break the free enterprise system. And how so many of us can be dupes and to believe these things. You ought to go back every once in a while and read the Constitution. It's not out of date. It's not a horse and buggy age. I'd like to report to you this evening that I find organizations, little pools of patriotic interest like this, are growing all over the country like mushrooms after a rain. They're springing up all over. One woman had me in Buffalo, and she had 30 women friends, and the next thing I knew, she had 600 people, and the next thing I knew, she had 2,000 people. I've been there three times. Now they want me to go back. They're going to fill an army with 5,000 people. They're nothing but good, plain, honest Americans, and they're worried about their money. They're worried about these wars that are talked about. They're worried about all these things. There's nothing wrong with being a rightist. It's time that groups like this, and we have to throw the torch to you young folk, you get your thinking like the twig is bent and think in terms basically that there isn't anything wrong with this country. It's as sound as a nut. All we have to do is preserve it. Thank you for inviting me.